This cup of Earl Grey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for the iPhone, iPad, iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Plus, if you would like to support our programming personally, please visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints, featuring original illustration by Toba Ushi.
This is Houston Huddleston from New Starship, and I'm restoring the Enterprise D bridge, and you're listening to Trek FM.
T. Earl Grey, hot.
It's time for another serving of Earl Grey, our dedicated TNG show. I'm Darren Moser, sitting in the center chair this week, commanding the three-nacelled future 1701D. Now, we're pulling into space dock to rendezvous with my co-host. Joining me from the USS Hood is longtime Badmiral, longtime Captain Philip Gilfus. Hey, Philip.
How are you doing, Darren? You know, would it just be helpful if I just kind of like stayed behind you, one parsec behind? I mean, we're going to rendezvous one week anyway, so I just figured might as well just stay in the same area, so that way just save everyone the time of any time you need to rendezvous with a ship. The Hood is always there to serve and be happy to do it.
No, I never worry about needing backup, even though I never request it. So I know you're just always around. You're like State Farm. You're always there.
That's right. I mean, we gave you our first officer. We give you our, you know, we transport your guest and special crew members. I mean, the Hood is here to serve.
The Hood just pretty much goes from the Enterprise to the Earth and back. That's all it does, is back and forth, back and forth. Enterprise gets the fun missions. The Hood gets the courier duty. Well, and announcing his first command on the USS Sutherland is Captain Daniel Prue. How are you doing, Daniel?
I'm good. A lot of the people here on the Sutherland really hate me for some reason, and I haven't figured out why.
Oh, that's really sad.
Yeah, no, and it's really frustrating because we're getting into crisis situations here, and with nobody listening to me, I'm gonna have to lay the smack down, I think.
Well, I think if you just run them into the ground with drills, people usually respond really well to that. And you change their rotation up, they really like that. It's like a fresh coat of paint.
Oh, all right. I'll have to give that a shot.
Yeah, but remember, you need to treat them like people, not machines.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, no, definitely treat them like people. You know, that above, forget what I said, listen to Philip, because, you know, I don't really know what I'm talking about. Well, tonight on Earl Grey, we're going to be discussing starships of the Federation, primarily ones around the 24th century. And while there are many, many different types of starships out there, I have narrowed it down to about five or six. So jumping in, we're going to start off with the Excelsior class, the workhorse. This is a ship that has been around for literally decades, from the time of James T. Kirk with the Great Experiment, which I guess would later be, I don't know, wasn't there a second Great Experiment? It seemed like every generation had its Great Experiment, but
Excelsior, we had some Great Experiments off when I was in college. I don't know if that was the same thing.
Not that kind of experimenting. No. But the Excelsior, what do we think about this ship? Let's start with you, Philip.
Oh, really? Because Daniel really is all about the Excelsior. Well, you know, but I'll go ahead and start.
I'd like to hear an objective view first before we jump into. I'm well aware of Daniel's preconceived notions on this class. So hold that proud and let's start.
We'll let his transwarp capabilities start to charge up, because I know it takes a while. Well, I think with the Excelsior class, you know, I think it's one thing that's interesting that we're going to talk about tonight. Because I think most of the ships we're talking about are from the TOS movies. You know, one critique I think you could have of TNG is that there weren't a lot of original Federation starship designs. There were a few, but
that's
most
true.
Of them were from the TOS movies. So we're starting with the Excelsior, obviously, from Star Trek III. And then we've seen it in Star Trek VI. But the Excelsior, as you said, that's kind of like was sort of the, you know, the Galaxy class in the 24th century, sort of the flagship. Those are the big guys. But for doing everything else, you still want a big starship. It's been the Excelsior class. And so as we mentioned with the USS Hood, I think the USS Crazy Horse is off the top of my head, was also another Excelsior class. Those are the ones that were always like, you know, transporting admirals and badmirals around to the Enterprise and ambassadors and all that stuff. But
shot of the Hood pulling away just to the right and then the Enterprise goes to the left. It's like burned into my memory because they use it so many times.
That's from Encounter, right? Encounter at Farpoint, and they just keep using it
for 7 years.
For the next 7 years.
Like, eh, oh, Captain DeSoto. Why make it a different ship when we can just reuse this shot?
Well, just like we never really saw the interior of the ship, at least in TNG. You know, Star Trek VI, you saw it, in Star Trek III. But you know, as far as the exterior, you know, it's certainly the long ship until we go with the Enterprise E of the fleet. You know, I don't know if I have anything original to say about it other than it's, you know, sort of oddly long, you know, long warp nacelles. You know, I have nothing bad to say about it because I want Daniel to have all of his negative comments for this one. but I mean, you know, it made sense. I think the thing about TNG as opposed to maybe Deep Space Nine and even Voyager is like most of the heavy duty starships, you know, the Galaxy class, Excelsior class. Like, you don't really imagining these things, like, turning on a dime or doing some, like, fancy barrel rolls or anything. Like, these things just, like, you know, steer like a, well, like a huge starship, you know? So, not exactly the most nimble things of, like, the Defiant doing backflips or something during the Dominion War.
No, that's a good point. It definitely, I get the feeling with the Galaxy, which we'll touch on later, but it just felt like they didn't make as many. But whereas this, you know, they just cranked them out. They got a bulk deal at the Federation shipyards for Excelsior classes. But
they're using them for 100 years.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you wouldn't want to waste that money. Oh, wait, no, never mind. That doesn't exist. So, Daniel, what are your thoughts for people who haven't listened to the last 14 episodes of Earl Grey on the Excelsior class?
Okay. The long and short of it is, I think it is... Well, I know for a fact it is. I mean, this is indisputable that it is the worst Enterprise design by far. But that's because it was kind of like the second-hand Enterprise at that point. So that doesn't really count, I guess. I think it's probably, to me, is one of the ugliest starship designs that we get. I hate it. I really do. I have a burning hatred for it. Like, every time I see it, I'm like, this is just a stupid-looking ship. It's, like, dumpy and fat-looking and, like... I mean, even though the Enterprise D... like Philip was mentioning, certainly will never get any points for maneuverability. I think that even more so, the Excelsior class is, it just looks like a ship that just goes straight. And you know what I mean? Like, and if it misses its, you know, it misses its stop, it'll just go all the way around until it gets back to where it's got to be, because it's going to be too much trouble and too much effort to turn in any meaningful way. And it's
like,
just,
let's go into orbit around this planet, slingshot around it, and maybe we can come back and our enemy will still be there.
Hopefully. Yeah, like they have to plan for, like, you know, orbiting planets like 3 sectors ahead. And,
no, is this like the Crown Victoria of space? Does it always have, like, the left blinker on the whole time that it's flying around?
Sulu, turn off that blinker.
And the thing is, it's like, it's so overused in Star Trek too. It wouldn't bother me so much because there are some pretty silly looking ship designs, I think, in Star Trek. But it's so overused. Like you were mentioning, Philip, like we get those like big shots in Deep Space Nine and during the Dominion War of like all of the fleets and stuff. And Excelsior makes up like 30-40% of the of the Starfleet fleet, and it's like, are you kidding me? You're going to send a 65-year-old vessel into a war zone? Like, what do you think is going to happen?
It is a 65-year-old design. We don't necessarily know that all these ships were made and have actually maintained, but I know what you're saying. It's like, we could crank out a lot of Galaxy classes, or we could just, you know, press paste on the Excelsior.
It's like the Constitution class was used for like 500 years, I think, by the Federation. You know, we're like, going to introduce it, then we're going to refit it, and they're going to keep on using it. You know, as many Constitution-class vessels we can make. So
that's true. Many of the large fleet shots, I always see Miranda classes, like, putzing around, but I don't see a lot of Constitution because I think they're afraid you're going to think it's the Enterprise, like Kirk's Enterprise, almost like, you know, but they did not overuse, but I know what you're saying, Philip, about that ship was just all you saw in TOS. I think of like the Ultimate Computer where it's fighting two other ships and they look identical to the Enterprise. They just, you know, scraped off the registry number and changed it. But yeah, it was.
But the thing is, I mean, yeah, it's easy to see it that way. But when we see the Reliant for the first time, which I believe is the first time that we see a non-Constitution class ship.
I think you're right.
Starship anyways. That's Star Trek II, and that's what, 25 years after, TOS. So we're looking at and by all accounts, the Enterprise was not a new ship in the beginning of TOS. So like, even then we're like, it would make sense to see Constitution classes flying everywhere because come on. I mean, like technology is constantly improving. You know, I mean, like, but there's a 7-year span between the Enterprise D and the Voyager. But all of a sudden, now we're designing new ships in a 5-year turnaround cycle. But all of a sudden, we're still using ships from last century. It doesn't make any sense. So I'm glad that they don't use those older models, even though they do. But, you know, the really, really old models, because it would be kind of ridiculous, I think.
You know, one thing, and this is a tangential TNG claim, but we can go with it. You know, in Generations, when we saw the Enterprise B, it was sort of a modified Excelsior.
You know, it's like a refit, I think, is what they call it.
Yeah, some added impulse engines.
Got the little cheeks around the deflector dish. That's what I like to call it.
Yeah, points in the nacelles a little bit. You know, less rounded than what we saw. But it's, you know, and we all know why. Obviously, we all know the real reason. But anyway, but still, it's funny that we saw the Enterprise B, and apparently they did not use the modified Excelsior design for another 100 years until we saw the Lakota and DS9.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm like,
which I want to speak about the Lakota for a second, because that fight scene, I feel, gave some weight back to the Excelsior class in my opinion. I think, I mean, obviously it's going up against the Defiant, which is a tough ship, but it's very little. And when it was fighting, I was like, okay,
little.
Exactly. I'm sorry, Mr. Worf, but it's a little ship. But I definitely felt when it was fighting the Lakota that the Lakota could have wiped it out, you know. But that goes back to our whole, you know, Federation weaponry versus other species weaponry. You know, that's another topic for another time. But what do you guys think of the Lakota fight of two Federation starships duking it out?
I think, Dan, you've talked about this, Daniel. I'll let you talk about this, about the Defiant, like, going in between the warp nacelles, and then just, like, you were saying, like the Defiant could just, you know, dock on top of the back of the hull there and just start, like, shoot from there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It seems to me that everybody, even people who don't like Deep Space Nine, are enamored with the Defiant. And since we're talking about ships, I can go off on a little bit of a tangent here. The Defiant, to me, is stupid. Like, I'm sorry, it's just dumb. It just doesn't make any sense. The ship is like,
you might as well call it the USS Kira.
I mean, I like it. It has cool moments. It's just, to me, like, if you're going to establish that the Galaxy class is the pride of the fleet, have one or two ships, I can't remember what that episode was, blow up a Galaxy class, and then all of a sudden, a season later, the Defiant is just taking out a bazillion of those same ships that took out that Galaxy class. It doesn't make any sense. I don't care. And this concept that we built it too powerful for itself is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. That doesn't even, like, that sounds like a fanboy, like, oh my god, it's so powerful, it can't even control itself. Like, it's like, what is that? But, yeah, I mean, so, I don't know, but on one hand, I say that, but on the other hand, you know, the Defiant is new technology. It's got, like, Borg technology integrated into it, and it's like, could it take out the Lakota? I don't know. The Lakota's, how old is that? How old is that ship? 50 years old? I don't know.
No, it's at least, if it's a retrofitted one, then it's probably a little newer, because it does have the kind of the extra impulse engines and all of those aspects. But I always felt in the Excelsior class, it looked kind of like a circular buzzsaw to me. Like if you're looking straight down and it has that little kind of U-shaped, track in the middle, like you just kind of start spinning that up and it's just going to like slice right into whatever it attacks, which I think that's Picard forgot he wasn't on an Excelsior when he rammed the Enterprise into the Scimitar, because I think an Excelsior would have been able to cut a little bit deeper.
He should have turned the ship sideways, yeah, like you said.
Because that always makes it fit. All right, well, moving on from the workhorse, let's move on to not the 1701D, so the Galaxy class. So there were not as many ships made in the Galaxy class. Obviously, the most famous is Picard's Enterprise, which was only captained by Picard, at least for the mainstay. I'm not really counting Jellicoe and other small captains, but he had the main run of that before it got crashed into a planet. But there are, I guess that's another, kind of standard TNG or Star Trek trope is, again, it's, oh, we're meeting another ship. Well, look, it just happens to look exactly the same as our ship,
Our sister ship, the Yamato.
Exactly.
But it's interesting because I think the TNG only did that once, with the Yamato. Like, we only saw another Galaxy-class ship once. Am I wrong? We only saw it once.
Well, we did see lots and lots and lots of alternative...
In parallels.
In parallel.
That was technically the Enterprise. But yeah. It's like the TOS when every starship was the Constitution class, like in The Ultimate Computer when they're doing the war games. Hopefully I'm getting episode titles right. Anytime you saw it, but like...
Doomsday Machine.
Yeah, we only saw the Galaxy class once in... Ayrton? No, I can't remember what it is. It's the one
it
with
was
the
a
Gellum?
Contagion, wasn't it?
Wait.
It was like... You're talking about the Yamato, right? Or are you talking about...
Yes,
it was Contagion. Yep, because the ship got sick or whatever it was. And it was
right.
Yeah,
it had a flu and exploded.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're right. Yeah, because technically they saw it another time when they had that alien that was tricking them into seeing it.
Nigilum.
Yes, that's what I was trying to think of.
That was the one with Worf, right? And he's like, two bridges?
Yes.
He like flips out.
Yeah, cannot comprehend.
If you ever want to freak out Worf, just make him think there's two bridges, and he will just lose his mind.
I see. Or two bridges.
Yeah, or give him the opportunity to make cake. That also gets him really agitated.
Oh, yeah. But you go back to the point. So that was the only time, I guess I can only guess, that the TNG folks were like, Enterprise D, no, that's the only Galaxy class. It's the man or woman. And that's it. We're not going to show any other ones. It's the dominant one. So, but it would have been interesting to see other ones. I know we saw them in Deep Space Nine. But,
Odyssey, right? That was the Odyssey?
Exactly. Yeah, the short list I have here is the Challenger, the Enterprise, the Galaxy, the Odyssey, the Venture, and the Yamato. And the Odyssey we see destroyed in Deep Space Nine. The Galaxy is obviously the prototype. Then the Enterprise, the Challenger, I think, was heavily used in the books, in the Starfleet Corps of Engineer books. I think that's Scotty's ship. And then the Yamato is, fatefully destroyed. The Venture, I think the Venture shows up at Deep Space Nine every once in a while. Like,
wasn't that the captain that had like the, you could see inside of his head that Dax dated or something?
I have to remember that episode. Who captained the Venture? The Venture was in service. The captain, it just takes me to the page of captain. So that doesn't really help. Task Force Admiral Hastur. Yeah. I think it was just the token, Galaxy class to show up, which I love in this picture it has of it. It's the Galaxy class docked at DS9, and in the back there's two Excelsior classes.
Every Galaxy class is assigned an Excelsior class starship. So the Enterprise had the Hood.
Oh yes,
but every other Galaxy class has an Excelsior class that follows it around.
They have so many, it makes sense. So
yeah,
but as a ship, it is interesting. Just how few of them we see. I mean, you would think how powerful this ship is and how well it served Picard. And it's kind of nice that like the flagship is that, and it's not, it's like semi rare, but yeah, kind of, it's like weird. Why didn't they make more? Was it development costs? Was it just time? I don't know.
I actually have a theory about that. Cause I have always wondered that myself. And so my assumption is, and I don't even know if this could be corroborated with like actual on-screen instances and stuff, but I always assumed that they made the Galaxy first, right? Cause that's what they always do. They right. named the first ship after the class. And then they created the Enterprise and the Yamato at the same time. Right. And cause they were sister ships. And then like afterwards,
sisters.
They just,
sisters, boom! Oh,
and then they just turn them out one at a time after that, I think. That's just, and I think, like, we don't get a bigger ship in Star Trek. You know, not a bigger Federation ship than the D. So even if it's, I mean, even if we're considering that there's infinite money or infinite resources or whatever, we can assume that it definitely has the longest build time. Like, yes. It would take forever.
And it took a long time to develop from, you know, the episodes we've seen. That go into
and then
that,
eventually,
its history.
And I also kind of consider it, and I don't know, again, I don't know, maybe you guys can remind me if there's something I'm forgetting, but I always think, like, this children on ships thing, like, family on ship thing, like, that was just an experiment they did with this class of ship. That it's never really, I don't think we ever see on screen it happen with any other class of ship. So
the,
I kind of think...
It's the great experiment of the 24th century.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right, exactly.
I think what slows down construction is, you know, we have that one shot of Utopia Planitia, and it literally looks like the surface of Mars, and there's like, I don't know, it looks like a scrapyard or like an airplane graveyard. You have a couple of saucers and a ton of nacelles all lined up, and it literally looks like they're putting it together on the surface. I'm like, wait. This isn't a toy kit you're assembling. You need to put this thing together in orbit, but... You know, who would be silly enough to build a starship on Earth and then lift it up? I don't know. That would just be crazy.
I mean, I usually build them in Iowa, but that's just me.
Oh, Philip.
Oh, man. We should not get into that. Cause yeah.
That is not one of the ships we'll be listing with tonight. But no.
I could talk forever about it, though.
Well, I mean, and I just to touch on that real quick for Galaxy Class, I mean, it is the biggest one because we were talking earlier in our ready room that... The Enterprise E, the Sovereign class, is not like bigger. I mean, it's different dimensions,
yeah,
but it's not bigger.
It's a smaller volume. It's a little bit longer, but every other dimension is smaller.
But I think there was a conscious decision made about like, dude, the Galaxy class is the hugest starship ever. We're never going bigger than that because then it just gets ridiculous. So you know, that's the high water mark of the, you know, size of starship is the Enterprise D, and so everything else will probably be a little bit smaller, a little bit more, you know, we'll play with longer and wider and all that stuff, but as far as just actual huge size, the Galaxy class will literally be the Galaxy class of starships.
Exactly. So, well, moving on, unless anyone has any other.
Well, do we want to talk about the modified Galaxy class?
Oh, yes, of course. We can touch
on
that.
Yeah, so in all good things, of course, yes.
No, go ahead, Philip.
Oh, yeah. I was like, I don't know why I'm suddenly taking over. It's your...
it's a coup!
You're so excited. I didn't want
to
interrupt
you. I know the listeners can't see. For this podcast, I have all my Star Trek micro machines in front of me. So all the ones we're talking about, I have them in my hand. So, in all good things, we have the future Enterprise D, commanded by Admiral Riker.
Warp 13,
yes. With its own cloak. Yeah. It has a cloak. It can go warp 13. Right. It has that infamous or famous, depending on your point of view, third nacelle. So interested what Daniel thinks about that. It has this really cool, I suppose, phaser cannon on the what's the opposite of dorsal? Ventral? On the ventral.
Ventral.
Yeah, and then on the dorsal, it has these sort of like, I don't even know what they're supposed to be, these little pointy things. Two of them on the saucer. I don't know, they're supposed to help static cling. I don't know. But anyway, so it certainly was a, and it actually has little I don't know, like things coming out of the bottom of the nacelles, support structures too for...
Oh, yeah,
to
like
give
little
it, to
wings.
Give it fins.
Yeah,
yeah, like
it
like
makes
a 57
it more aerodynamic,
Chevy Bel Air.
Obviously, That's how it can fly vertically up through the Klingon cruiser. The D couldn't have done that, you know, without those, you know, those wingtips. But
well, I think the thing is with the third nacelle, it can no longer fit into the space dock, and so those grooves it fits into the outside of the space dock. So anyway. But it was interesting about how they're also how do they get out of the main shuttle bay with that third nacelle in the way?
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah. How do they get out of the back shuttle bays? Any of the shuttle bays? Well, I remember having the Playmates conversion Future Enterprise, and it was actually a toy where it had little parts that you could pop open, and you could actually transform it from the, you know, the regular Enterprise D to the All Good Things one, and that was really fun, and it was a great toy. And but every time I, you know, snapped that third nacelle on, it just looked ridiculous. It just didn't work.
That's the biggest thing, right? Like, that's the biggest problem with it, is the fact that it looks like they just glued some extra pieces onto the model and then filmed it. That's the problem with it. Like, if they could have somehow, and I know this is budget, and it's fine, like, it doesn't bother me about the episode, but thinking about it, it's like, okay. But if they could have somehow, like, had as big of a transformation between the D and the future D that they did between the, like, Enterprise, the original Enterprise and the refit, then it would have been cool. Like, you could still have that third nacelle and make it look cool, but you would have to somehow slightly change other things, like the form factor, and then I would be on board with it. But it just looks like glued Lego pieces to the model that they were using, and it looks really cheesy.
Well, if they did the same concept of the original series, of the TV series to the movies, basically, you know, retired ambassador Captain Picard would have gone and like, oh, there's Admiral Riker's ship, the Enterprise. He's like, where is it? No, you see that huge ship right there? Yeah, that's the Enterprise. What do you mean? It doesn't look anything like my Enterprise. It's twice as big and would in no way be the same ship. No, that's the refit. Oh, okay. So.
And Philip, you asked earlier how I felt about the third nacelle, and
yes.
I'm not sure if either of you two have seen Total Recall.
I knew this was coming up.
So I guess the way I'll put it diplomatically is an interesting thought experiment, but maybe not completely practical. And that's all it goes against.
I believe in the Star Trek Bible or in Roddenberry's, you know, description of warp technology, you had to have an even number of warp nacelles. They had to, and they also had to quote unquote see each other, you know, where at least the blue part had to be able to visually, if you were to look out from one to the other, see. And I think that's how many of the ships were designed. Later, you know, that kind of was pushed to the side. I mean, I don't think the Defiant really follows that principle or some other, but, you know, another mark against the Defiant. But
well, one starship that was quote-unquote introduced into TNG, even though it was supposed to predate TNG, was that big yellow model on Captain Picard's ready room, the Constellation-class Stargazer, which technically had four nacelles.
Right. But they're even, and they can see each other. So.
Which isn't the only ship that has four nacelles, is it? Oh, man, maybe I just backed myself into a corner there. I thought there was another one.
There is the Prometheus experimental one in Voyager.
Oh, yeah, but that doesn't count. I thought there was another one.
How does that not count? It qualifies as another ship with four nacelles.
Technically, it's Voyager. Technically two nacelles that split, right?
It's four ships.
It's three ships. Oh, no, it's one ship that splits into three parts, just like the D is one ship that splits into two parts.
Right. Yeah.
It's not a Voltron. It's one ship.
An owl formed the saucer.
Yeah. Form the cell and battle bridge. Okay, well.
So many buttons.
Oh, so many buttons. Now, kind of, we were talking about how the Reliant was basically a kitbash of the, you know, what they had on hand for the original Constellation class, but we also now are moving to the Nebula class, which we have Captain Data on the USS Sutherland, and I think the Nebula class showed up in the Best of Both Worlds episodes. I'm not 100% sure of when it was first introduced, but it definitely is basically you take the saucer section of a D and you kind of shove it down into the neck so that it's touching the drive section. And then you take the nacelles and you flip them upside down, and then you put a it looks like a radar dish, you know, from those I can't remember what class of airplane that is we have nowadays, but you put some sensor photon torpedo module on the top, and presto, you know, you have a Nebula class. So I actually like this class. I think it's a pretty, you know, you can tell where, obviously, if you're thinking in universe, it's like, okay, we're putting all this work and all this build time into this galaxy class. Now, is there a way we can make a cheaper, smaller, not modular, I'm not thinking like they're just snapping the parts together, but you know, but you could take the same design principles and put it together, and I buy it enough, but maybe you guys don't by your jeckling laughter.
No, I just feel like you're arguing that like there's some subcontractor. He's like, oh wait, you just wanted 6 saucers? I made like 10. Oh, you only have like six secondary holes? Well, what are we going to do with all these extra saucers?
Designing it, and they want to use those plans rather than build another, you know, design another ship.
But that's exactly what they did. I mean, I'll tell you guys a story, and this might be slightly embarrassing for someone who claims to be a Star Trek fan, but I remember one of the first times I ever watched Generations. And, you know, I had seen Star Trek, but I never watched it, like, religiously like I do now. And the scene at the end when this class ship, and there's a couple other ships that are leaving orbit, and they're all transporting away, I actually thought that ship had just somehow grabbed the saucer section that had crashed onto Viridian 3 and was, like bringing it away. Like, it was like a tow ship or something. Because I was like, this is exactly the same.
Yeah.
This is the same piece. This is the Enterprise piece that's just attached to like a tow spaceship that's bringing it out of orbit.
That's funny.
And it wasn't until much later that I'm like, wait a minute. No,
because
exactly.
That's actually
it does look like that. Yeah. So it came down and grabbed it, and then it went like, you know, made the swoosh sound and was like, whoosh, here we go.
that's what I thought because like, if you were to take that image of it leaving orbit and remove the nacelles and remove the top part there, it would look like the same scene of the D saucer section crashing into the planet. It's played backwards. Yeah, you could play it backwards, and it's exactly the same. And, you know, I didn't think when I was younger, oh, hey, that's crashed on the planet. It's all broken in half and cracked everywhere, so there's no possible way.
Itself cannot be salvaged.
Yeah. But I was like, oh, they're just bringing it back because it's easier than just teleporting everyone, I guess. I think you should have said,
and so it'll be turned into a memorial museum. Because it's like, seriously, are they just going to leave it on the planet? I mean, the Romulans are probably going to zip over the first chance they get. Because they've been trying to get a look inside. Maybe they'll just go on the tour. And they'll surgically alter themselves and they'll go on the Enterprise-D memorial tour.
If we're going to talk about the sanctity and reverence of life in Generations, they put Kirk's body and put a bunch of rocks over him, okay? There's not obviously a lot going on.
That's true.
No, but if the Romulans would not have gone on the tour. They would have taken that back to Romulus and burned it in the center of their square.
I thought it'd be really fun to commission a painting of that, of the broken hull of the Enterprise in the center square of the Romulan capital. I think that would look awesome.
Wouldn't it just block out the sun, though? Because it's a huge ship. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, it's over a city, not by comparison, but yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's funny, Darren, what you said. I mean, it's obvious to everyone, but like literally they're like, hey, you know what we did with the Constitution class, the Miranda? Let's do that exact same thing with the Galaxy and the Nebula. Like, really? Should we just do the exact same? People are going to notice. Ah, it's a new generation. They won't notice.
It's literally the Miranda 2.0. It is.
Yeah.
Because, I'd forgotten about that module at the top of the Miranda. But now that you say that, I'm like, oh my gosh, it literally is Miranda 2.0. It's your Miranda rights.
in the Sutherland episode, which I don't know why I'm blanking, Redemption?
Redemption Part 2, yeah.
I saw a clip of that. I was on YouTube or something, and like I saw the shot of that ship, and I was like, oh my god, that's
just
not
chilling out in space.
Well, yeah, it's not really great. But then you look at Generations when they actually, you know, had the money and chance to do it right, and I'm like, oh no, that looks really cool the way they did it here. So I mean, it's definitely you know,
maybe that's why they kept it so far away from the camera in the episode, because the model they made was so small, it probably didn't look very good.
So they literally just cut the micro machines in half and then glued those pieces.
Or probably not micro machines, but they probably literally pulled a model off of a Target shelf and built it, and then that's probably what they did. That's what I would have done.
But just to bring it up, because we were just talking about it, in that shot of all those ships leaving Viridian 3, it is both the Nebula class and the Miranda class, I think, right?
Oberth class.
Yeah. But there's three of them, right? There's three ships. So it's like, so here are our two, no attempt ships here.
ships in the quadrant.
No, gosh.
And where was the hood? Where was the hood?
Huh? The hood was destroyed in the Battle of Wolf 359.
Oh, no. Oh, gosh. Is that true?
Pretty sure it was. I know that the ship that an admiral was on, I think it was destroyed. Oh, that's right. He transferred the Crazy Horse, which, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't know if I'd want to be on that ship called the Crazy Horse. I mean, yeah. But, last thoughts on the Nebula, just with it being Data's first command, or at least command away from, you know, the Enterprise D. And I think, you know, I always love when Data, I mean, I know we all enjoy when Data is put in command. It's just, although I have to say, their bridge was like a closet.
I mean, I was just going to say that.
The smallest bridge, he could literally, he didn't need anybody, because literally he could turn around and the master systems display is like inches from his nose. And yeah, I mean, so I don't know. You'd think, if it was based off of, it literally should have had a slight redress of the D bridge, is really what it should have had.
Kind of glad they didn't do that, though.
I'm glad they didn't either, but it's still.
Well, maybe the bridge is located in the top part instead of the saucer section. You know?
Oh, in the little like radar triangle.
Exactly.
So it can eject like an Arrowwing fighter and, you know, land itself on the, who knows, who knows. Well, next up on our list is it's only seen in one episode, but it made such an impact, not in a positive way, but we're going to talk about the Olympic class, which is the USS Pasteur, the hospital ship from captained by Dr. Beverly Crusher in Good Things.
What's her name?
Dr. Beverly Picard.
Oh, she kept the name.
But so this is a ship where, it's a little more original. It's very much smaller. I mean, the scale is a lot smaller. And you know it's a medical ship because it's got a giant snake and cross and staff on like every surface imaginable, on the nacelles, on the front. But it's basically, they took the Trade Federation sphere from episode one and just shoved it on the front of a couple of warp nacelles and a weird looking. I mean, I know they didn't, because obviously that movie came out later, but it's literally what they did.
So I'm a little concerned. How does the saucer separation work? If this thing hits a planet, you're going to be going upside down as this thing rolls the entire way down the planet.
It might make for a smoother landing experience, though. I'm not sure. Just the rolling might be. I don't know. Do you guys like this? It's just kind of silly looking, but I don't care. It doesn't bother me.
Doesn't keep you awake at night.
Unlike most Starfleet vessels, the Olympic class features a spherical primary hull, similar in outward appearance to the Dauntless class. That's right. That is a dumb ship, though. The Dauntless is like literally a sphere with a warp nacelle sticking out its butt. Like, it's the weirdest looking ship. But yeah.
Well, I think with the Pasteur, two things. One, I'm curious on what Daniel thinks of those nacelles, because it looks almost TOS-y. But also, it almost reminds me of, like, the old ships we would see in the original series, but not like the old ships of the original series, but like it was the 23rd century and like, hey, here's your really old ships from the 22nd and 21st century that we used. Looked like that. You know, like I can't remember like the SS, whatever, that we sent out in deep space and got lost and now we're getting a distress signal. I mean, one thing I do like is that, you know, both in and I'm trying to think of an example in TOS movies, there might not be one, but at least in TNG of like, okay, are we just going to keep using the saucer? Like every time, are we always going to use the, is that like the
saucer and primary hole and two nacelles? Saucer, yeah, primary hole, two nacelles. Like, yeah.
So like, I mean, here it is. They're trying to use something different, which look, I'm for something different. That's fine. And so, yeah, I'm with y'all and like, I don't have a problem with it. It's not my favorite. I don't hate it. It's just, it is what it is.
Yeah. It's in no way offensive because it's a very specialized ship. I mean, if we had see, if this was like the next Enterprise, I think everybody would be like, what? No way. This is so stupid. But it's like, it's very clearly stated that this is a medical ship designed for the. So it doesn't have to have nice nacelles because it doesn't have to go fast. It doesn't matter. Right. It's like, it just does what it does, and that's a thing. And that's okay. I'm totally okay with that. It's non offensive to me.
It's really good transporters and a lot of medical bays, a lot of bio beds.
But that warp core is really sensitive. That thing will breach like that. You just want to be careful. You don't want to take that thing into battle.
No. But, you know, I think their main vision was, we need a ship that, like you said, doesn't look like every other ship or has a visual contrast to the Enterprise D. And it's also better that it's smaller because, again, they were trying to sneak across, you know, I mean, it's literally made for this episode. So it doesn't necessarily have to have this long history of use, but
I do want to say one thing that now that you guys brought it up, because there is a lot of criticism in Star Trek for ship design, for the fact that yes, every ship has to have two nacelles and a saucer section, and because that's how it was in the original series, and I understand the criticism, but I actually kind of appreciate it because, I mean, you could say the same thing about cars, right? Like, every car has
four,
a hood and
four wheels.
And rectangle configuration.
But it's like, okay, but we've had probably, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of different designs of cars that can all look crazily different. So I think that it's, and I think this is something hopefully we'll see more in a future Star Trek incarnation, is that you can take that basic design and do crazy awesome things with it. And it doesn't, that limitation kind of breeds creativity. It doesn't hamper it. And I hope that we get to see that later on.
I think the other factor in this is that in the Star Trek universe, you're also creating ships for other races. And so it's almost like that's kind of the palette of the Federation, so that you can tell instantly, okay, this is what a Federation ship looks like. So when it shows up on screen, you're not like, oh my gosh, we're being attacked. Oh, wait, no, that's the Federation. Oh, that's another Federation ship. It doesn't look anything like the rest of the fleet. You know, they all have their matching, you know,
Defiant. sorry about that.
Did you say something today?
Oh, yeah.
Nope,
yeah.
No, I'm good.
But
you had a very tiny cough.
You know, well, think of it this way: it kind of looks like a person. You know, it's got, if you look down from the top, because the Cardassian ships look like Cardassians with their necks, and you know, Klingon ships kind of look like the Klingon symbol, and you know, I don't know. But no, I hope in future Star Trek, though, they do, like you said, branch out at least a little bit to incorporate other design types.
I mean, well, it was interesting, and again, not to deviate from Starfleet ships, but the Klingons were in Next Generation. They did actually kind of go two ways, because they did inherit the Bird of Prey and kept that from the original series movies. But then they went to the Vorcha class, which is I think it's radically different from the Bird of Prey. And so, but you could still recognize both as Klingon, but it's almost two hugely different designs of Klingon ships. And so, you know, there's obviously room for spectrum.
The Romulan Warbird, I mean, that didn't look anything like the TOS era ships we've seen. I mean, that thing is massive. I think that's the real reason they put that third nacelle on the Enterprise D, so it wouldn't fit inside a freaking Romulan Warbird, because it's ridiculous. Okay, well, let's rounding out our short selection here. We have the the little Oberth class, also known as the fishing boat of the fleet. I actually looked it up. Oberth is based off of the father of German rocketry. So obviously some of the most famous Oberth classes are the Grissom from Star Trek III. And then it's very infamous. And then, but you also have the Pegasus from that great episode in TNG that's fused into solid rock.
Was that?
Yeah, that was a Grissom. Oh. That was a Oberth class. So, this ship, I mean, it's very small. I mean, when you start to look,
Tchaikovsky.
Yes, that was the other one with the Naked Now. So those are the kind of the three, at least that are known to the average Star Trek viewer. But with the Pegasus, I think it. One, I love that shot of it like fused into rock. I mean, that's just such a cool shot to create. Did they like build the ship and then did they make an extra ship and just cut it up, or did they just hate that design so much they're just like, hey, let's just shove this into a rock? But it's just a very small ship. It was used for scientific missions, but you literally put it next to anything. You put it next to a runabout, and it looks small.
The one thing about the design, the science vessel, apparently just one torpedo will blow it up, only if it's a lucky shot. And also it's good for asteroid shielding. But, and I only discovered this maybe three months ago, and I don't know if I was listening to another podcast or reading a book or something about this ship design, and they brought up this huge point, and I never saw it before, never realized it till now. How the heck do you get to the top part if you're in a turbo lift? Because if you're in the bottom hull, do you go up into the warp nacelles?
Up and then in. It's like a jigsaw puzzle.
It's they have the transporters built directly into the turbo lift system.
Yeah.
Because nothing ever bad happens with the transporter system. So that's how they.
Oh yeah. Well, it's only got 13 decks and it's got a crew of 80. Five minimal. So I think Kirk should have just stolen this ship. You wouldn't have needed to automate it. You could just crew it with a crew of five. But I don't know how they get between. I mean, it's very interesting because you would think that, I would almost put the warp core in the top part because it just has a direct line to the nacelles back there. But yeah, it's an interesting class. I think, again, that whole kind of split hull thing.
But it's radically different, though. It is radically. I mean, even though it's from the TOS movies, obviously, but it is a radically different design.
It sits in the same category as the last one we talked about, where I kind of appreciate these smaller, less important, very specific ships that are designed for a job to do. I like that. I think it pads out the universe. I think it makes sense that they would have this ship to do these kinds of missions and this ship, but then we would have the big important ships be designed for everything, and correct, they would have the recognizable silhouette and the recognizable design, and then these more very specific ships would they could have creative liberty to just go crazy. Why not?
They're sort of the Volvos of the fleet. They're reliable, they're dependable, they get you what you need to do. You're not going to take it out on your first date with anyone. But,
they're prone to having their hatches pop open,
You're not going to bring it on a mission to the neutral zone,
right?
But you will do. You have things to do. It's a busy universe out there. So yeah, why not?
No, exactly. It's you gotta. You gotta have something for them to fly around in, and I think later it was. Oh, that's what I was gonna say. At least they didn't do. They didn't starbase it and just say, oh, well, let's just use the same model and just make it look like it's eight times as large. It's almost comparable to an Excelsior class now. They just built it bigger.
It's like Space Dock reminds me of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. It's like, let's go to Space Dock. It's only a model. Shh.
No, let's not go there. It's a silly place. Sometimes
it is a silly place.
Sometimes it fits an Excelsior. Sometimes it can fit a whole galaxy class.
How true.
So we've talked about a lot of great starships on today's episode, the Excelsior class, the Galaxy class, Nebula class, Olympic class, and Oberth class, along with some others sprinkled in there. But if you have a particular class of Starship that you enjoy, please join us on our forums at trek.fm/forums. We'd love to talk and continue this conversation about, you know, just which class is better. Let's just draw the lines here and now and just have an all out forum war on. No. Let's have a nice civil discussion about how we all hate the Defiant. I mean, No. But no, it's a tough little ship.
Explain why you like the Defiant A better than the original Defiant.
Oh, stop. You're going to get me real upset right now.
It's been fun talking with you guys about all these different Starship classes in TNG, but that's not the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Rewriting TOS Season 1 with Mark Cushman.
This is a show that was an excellent show. Let's face it. It was, I think, one of the best shows ever made. Certainly the best show at that time. I think the best written show. Because Gene Roddenberry was so determined that every episode would have a strong theme and make a statement.
Earl Grey.
TNG Season 8.
Or no, this is it. The Traveler is a Q, and so the Traveler shows up with Wesley. Q shows up and's like, Q, what are you doing here?
I go by T now.
The Orb.
Sisko is captain versus commander.
I mean, with the war and everything going on, there's a part of him that's really hardened. But at the same time, when it comes to the people that are around him, whether it's Cassidy, which, you know, the idea that he would forgive Cassidy, I wouldn't see him doing that in the first few seasons.
The Ready Room.
The Game.
But the ending of the episode is Data flashing a flashlight, and I think that's kind of a lame ending. I just wanted to bring
you. You wanted to say the end of the episode was Data flashing people on the bridge.
I know. That's also part of Daniel's fanfic number 58.
To the journey!
The 37's commentary.
I had a dream the other day where I met Robert Beltran in a Macy's, and I, like, totally geek out on him, but I try to say, like, oh, no, I totally have also know you from your Hispanic and Native American plays, and, like, I was trying to, like, BS my way through saying I only know you from Star Trek Voyager.
Did it work?
I woke up. Warp 5.
Horror on Enterprise.
It's not just losing control of yourself, it's the fact that, zombies, even zombie Vulcans, cannot be reasoned with.
Some would say that normal Vulcans can't be reasoned with, Kate.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Harlan Ellison recap.
Well, I also think it's entirely possible that Harlan Ellison has encountered a lot of people ripping off his stuff because he's actually a prophet. And he just saw the future and thought, that's a good idea for an Outer Limits episode.
Literary Treks.
Q and Trelane Comics.
Kirk is actually doing the hands thing that he does, you know, where he's trying to make a point with his hands.
Yeah, that's right.
He's actually doing it in the comic. It's fantastic. It feels just like Kirk.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and get in on the Daily Trek Talk. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can stream and download files from the website. Just visit trek.fm/pd for the podcast directory to get all the links. Now, if you'd like to contact us about the show, just go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. You can choose send a show and choose Earl Grey, and that will send an email to all three of us. You can also use the tab on the right-hand side of any page of the website to send us a voicemail using your webcam's microphone. Or you can talk to us and other listeners on the forums about your favorite Starship class at trek.fm/forums. In social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username trekfm. Now, if people want to debate nacelle configurations with you, Daniel, how would they get a hold of you?
Well, you don't debate nacelle configurations with the world's foremost nacelle expert, but you can discuss them with
me. We couldn't get him on the show, Daniel, so...
okay. Twitter would be the best way, per usual. I am at 1UpDan. That is the number one, not the word.
And if people want to describe how exactly that Olympic class would separate with you, Philip, how would they get a hold of you?
Well, you can have a ball and catch me on Twitter at NC Public Servant. That's NC like North Carolina, NC Public Servant.
Q, sure it's not NCC public servant? Because it sounds like you're launching your own Starship.
When I first started Twitter, it was actually NX public servant, but never mind.
And if you want to reach me, I'm on Twitter under Dr. Sci-Fi. That's DrSciFi. Or you can visit my website, drscifi.com, where we'll be relaunching the Dr. Sci-Fi show in January.
Now, would this be the refit version of Dr. Sci-Fi?
Yes, it'll be slightly larger, and people will like it way better than the one with the satellite dish.
So have you gained like 30 pounds since the end of the beginning, you know, since the end of Dr. Sci-Fi?
There's a reason my webcam doesn't go down that low, but I'd prefer that you not bring that up. So.
Okay, sorry.
Now, before we go, we'd like to also ask you to please support our sponsors who make it possible for us to bring Earl Grey and our other shows to you each week. Our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to read, but never thought you'd have time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers, Audible has something for everyone. There are many next-generation books available on Audible, including Dark Mirror and Q-Squared, both read by John Delancey. And I personally have read Dark Mirror, and it's one of my favorite Mirror Universe tales. It's set in the TNG era. As a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see how great Audible is. So give it a try today, catch up on all those classic books you've yet to read, or that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. We thank you and Audible for supporting Trek FM and Earl Grey. Also, help us continue to bring Earl Grey to you each week by getting your alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Toba Ushi. You'll find them at trek.fm/donate, and your support helps us to pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the show to you each week. So I'm going to head back to my workshop, and I have, you know, all these gold models out that I'm kind of polishing, and I haven't decided yet if I want to hang them in like a 3/4 view or just slice them all in half and just shove them in the wall. It's, I don't know. I think if I do that though, then I could give you guys a copy that's facing the other way, or, you know, I think 2-for-1, I think that's where I'm going to go. So I'll put all of my wonderful Enterprises, on the wall. I don't know if the wife's going to like that too much, but you know, it looks good, you know, if you like sleeping in the observation lounge. But
if she doesn't like it, she can just smash your little ships, so you don't have to worry about it.
Oh, and I haven't even read Moby Dick yet this year. It won't make sense. The references. So thank you again for joining us here on Earl Grey. Live long and prosper.
Engage.
Make it so.
Fire.